Hello, I'm Susan Flory, and this is The Big Middle, my podcast exploring the big issues of longer midlife, rethinking aging in a world obsessed with youth. My sponsor this week is Five-A-Side Chess, a social enterprise here in the UK tackling the epidemic of loneliness and social isolation by bringing the generations together over a game of chess. As everywhere across the so-called First World, age segregation is a key driver of Britain's epidemic of loneliness and social isolation. Stephen Burke is campaigning to end it. United for All Ages is the social enterprise he runs with his wife Denise. We're in a pub in Shepherd's Bush, your West London-based Stephen, and near enough mine. Is this your local when you're down from Norfolk?
Well, this is my old stomping ground. I lived in Shepherd's Bush for over 25 years, and I grew up and was born in West London. I still support Brentford Football Club. I have a season ticket there, so I feel it's very much part of my blood, as is the pub, you know, and my grandparents used to work for Fuller's, so it's very much part of my blood.
Our choice of venue certainly speaks to our topic. Pubs, they may be fewer across the land these days, but they're still the beating social heart of most UK neighbourhoods, right?
Yeah, and they are also, in many places, they are places where people of all ages can mix, and certainly this pub, you come here on a Friday evening and there are all generations from 2 to 102 here. That's not the case for every single pub, and a lot of pubs are very segregated by age, but many places, and in other countries like Ireland as well, they are a key mixing place.
Yeah, it's delicious on a Sunday lunch to see the little ones running around.
Yes, exactly, and with everyone else around them.
Now, you've been campaigning for social change for many years. Let's hear about some of the roles you've held before we get to now and United for All Ages.
Yes, I've been chief executive of a couple of national charities, one in the field of childcare, Daycare Trust, which was campaigning for childcare for all for parents and obviously young children, giving young children the best start in life. I then worked for an elder care charity, so helping support older people and their carers. So I've worked at both ends of the age spectrum, and at the same time I've had political roles. I was leader of the council here in Hammersmith and Fulham.
That's a big job.
It was a big job, and I was still chief executive of a charity at the same time. So I was burning the candle at both ends. So,
yeah, racing from one office to another.
Indeed, but I was able to influence government nationally and put things into practice locally.
Tell us about United for All Ages, how it came to be, what you do.
Well, my wife and I had both worked in childcare, and myself in elder care, and we felt it was time to actually bring the different ages together. Denise had set up, with the support of the Mayor for London, the first intergenerational centre in the capital, in Merton.
Is that still going?
And that's still going. That was in 2008-09, and Boris Johnson ended up planting a capsule there, which will be unearthed in some point in the future.
This is the former Mayor of London.
That's
now we've
right.
got Sadiq Khan.
Yes, so that was opened about 10 years ago now, and we wanted to create many more of these kind of places. So almost 10 years ago, we decided to set up United for All Ages. When we moved to Norfolk, we'd had a career break. We both left our jobs for different reasons, and we had this vision really about how we might bring older and younger people together to try and tackle some of the problems in our society, whether it's about age segregation, but there are also big problems facing children and young people in our society, and obviously older people in our society, around ageism and loneliness. I'd been involved in setting up the campaign to end loneliness as well. So this was all natural territory. But I think the longer we've been working at it, the more focus we've become as to why we exist. But I think what we've seen in our society is that over that last 10 years, we've become much more divided as a country. We're divided around class, around race, around income, and around geography, but we're also particularly divided around age. And that's become particularly obvious around Brexit.
Yeah.
Brexit is the obvious symptom. But if you look at some of the stats that when people get to around 50, they're much over 50, they're much more likely to vote Conservative, and under 50, they're much more likely to vote Labour. And that is a huge division in our society, and we need to do things to bring people together to talk about these issues, because older and young people have a lot more in common than they have that divides them. And that's what we've got to do, is actually get people talking with each other and overcoming these issues.
Yeah, and it's funny, when I was researching all about you, I came across a report from It was a national survey, one of the most recent ones, all about loneliness. And it was saying that young people feel intensely lonely, more than stereotypically older people, middle-aged and the elderly. 40% age 16 to 24 say they feel lonely often or very often. 29% said yes to that, 65 to 74-year-olds. And 27% of those over 75. So we really need to redesign how we're living.
That's right. I mean, when we set up the Campaign to End Loneliness about 10 years ago, everyone assumed it was about older people. And I said at the time, you know, you don't suddenly become lonely when you reach the age of 65 or whatever. Loneliness is something that can hit you at any point in your life. And I think the way our society is going now is that I think younger people find probably that they are more lonely now because of things like social media and the way things are organised than perhaps many older people are. And yeah, they don't have the resilience either, necessarily.
And they don't have, you know, with fractured families and living your life online in the main, they don't have the role models and the support system.
Yes, and they don't see many older people in their lives either. Their contact with a lot of their peers is through their phone, and it's not a personal contact at all. And it's such an important time in their lives.
It's been 10 years, and you earn money and keep going as a social enterprise. How?
We run it as a social enterprise. It's funded through consultancy work that we do for organisations that are interested in developing intergenerational projects. But we also cross-subsidise from some other work that we do. So we have some non-executive directorships, for example.
OK, so you don't get big slices of lottery money? No, like some of the other players in this space?
We don't. We perhaps should do, but we will keep going. What we try and do is act as a catalyst. So we're interested in changing society. And so a lot of the stuff that we publish is all about promoting a different way of organising our society, running things, and supporting people to interact with each other. And then, obviously, our consultancy helps organisations at whatever level in our country to make that happen in practice. So, that, in a sense, that's a kind of self-perpetuating model, I hope.
Right. Well, you say that you're a think and a do tank, right, which is a cute little play.
Yeah, I mean, we're certainly a think tank, but we are very much about making it happen as well.
And you're helping others get these programs up and running.
We have no desire to run hundreds and hundreds of projects ourselves. We couldn't possibly do that, but we can inspire and encourage others to do so. For a lot of people, it is just about having enough support at the very earliest stages to make it happen. Getting started, for a lot of people, whether it's a nursery linking up with a care home, there are quite a few barriers, and it's about helping people over those barriers. Once they get going, they're fine.
Is a huge part of the problem in this country the fact that we've suffered 10 years of deep government spending cuts? Austerity has meant local authorities have to rely on philanthropy to keep youth centres and libraries open, and that's not working. So how do you work to involve all the layers of society to fix things instead of this scattershot approach we've got now?
Well, certainly public spending cuts have been a huge issue over the last 10 or so years in the UK. But I think this trend towards age segregation has been going on for longer and has been probably last 40 to 50 years. And that's the longer-term trend that we're trying to address. And age segregation, you know, the lack of a connection between people of different ages leads to a lack of trust and ultimately division. So that's what we're trying to address by bringing people together and building mutual confidence and understanding and tackling some of the stereotypes that arise from that. The projects that are now emerging in this country, it's just phenomenal. In the last 3 years, we've seen a massive explosion in local projects. And it's not happening because of central government at all. Central government's not doing anything. It's stymied by Brexit, apart from anything else. But what we're seeing is that people actually think it's the right thing to do, bringing people of different generations together at a local level, and they're actually making it happen themselves without government funding, without government policy. they're doing it themselves. And that's why it's so encouraging. And it's sustainable because people are actually making it happen themselves.
Well, we're starting to wake up to it, aren't we? We're seeing the damage that's being done. Young people, knife crime is at epidemic levels here. Astonishing what we read every day in the papers about four people knifed.
Yes. And I mean, and so many of the issues that affect our society, whether it's crime or poverty or poor health, can be solved with by an intergenerational approach as well.
You came up in the most recent report that I read online, Next Generation, yeah. You called it. You had a lot of sensible schemes, and you were proposing planning reforms and tax and benefit changes. Can you run through some of those ideas?
We decided to focus on the next generation because a lot of projects, intergenerational projects, have emphasised the benefits for older people in terms of tackling loneliness, improving care and health and so on. But actually, if you look at our society, it's probably the next generation, the youngest, who are facing some of the biggest problems in our society in terms of getting a good start in life, in terms of educational achievement, finding secure and long-term jobs. But also, they're facing some massive social problems, whether it is loneliness on the one hand or whether it's issues around crime and poverty. And so it's really important that intergenerational projects are seen to be able to solve some of those tough issues, those big issues in our society.
Well, we're seeing such a mismatch between salaries and rents. We blame young people for being the boomerang generation. You know, I was reading something on, I think it was the BBC News website yesterday, and it was this woman who was saying, my living situation is hell because she's living with her 23-year-old. Well, the 23-year-old is working full-time but cannot afford rent, cannot afford to finance himself. And this is what's happening all over the place. Everything's broken.
Yes, and obviously those big issues like housing and taxation need to be addressed by national government. I mean, that, people can't do that on their own. And so, you know, the central government needs to, for instance, build 300,000 affordable homes every year for the next 20 years to even start to make an indent on that particular problem.
Well, we keep getting vague promises around that, don't we?
Yeah, but actually the reality is not quite matching the promises, I'm afraid. But the other key thing is looking at the way our taxation system works. And there are a lot of elements of the taxation system favour older people. We need to look at taxing income less and taxing wealth more. And most of the wealth lies with people aged 55 and over in this country.
And I liked your ideas about changing the benefit rules to encourage parents so that grandparents can have a role in things.
There's certainly much more that we could do to support grandparents who are providing some kind of care for grandchildren.
What's the change you're proposing?
I mean, the government have already introduced something called a national insurance credit to support grandparents who are providing care for grandchildren, because obviously they're not going to be working if they're doing that. So it helps them build up their pension.
So instead of paying the nanny or the nursery, the money can go to a member of the family or even a fictive grandmother, grandfather.
Well, at the moment, it's about a national insurance credit. It's not actually payment for undertaking childcare. And personally, I don't think we should be paying grandparents to undertake childcare because that's the state interfering in family life.
But a lot of older people are living quite close to the bone, so...
Yeah, I mean, and that's the issue. What we need to have is much more flexible working so that older people can work and provide care, whether it's for an older relative or whether it's for grandchildren. But if work's more flexible, then they're able to do so. And so many parents rely on the grandparents to pick up the pieces, really, in those situations. And we have to recognise that our economy wouldn't function without grandparents doing all of this.
So you're seeing a lot of developments in the UK that are giving you cause for optimism. Which ones in particular?
The most amazing thing is seeing thousands and thousands of nurseries linking with care homes, for example, or older people's housing and care schemes. And that has taken off, as I said, within the last 3 years. That is just incredible. It's actually enabling those children to meet older people, spend time with older people, understand what's happening for older people with older people.
And it's not like once every 2 months. It's a weekly visit, or twice weekly?
This is weekly. We're seeing the emergence of a lot of parent and toddler groups as well. So parents taking their young children into a care home on a weekly basis, undertaking lots of arts and crafts and musical activities. But that also benefits the parents as well as the young children and the older people. For us, in the longer term, what we're looking at is seeing care homes and nurseries being co-located on the same site.
As in Singapore?
As in Singapore.
Germany.
Singapore are doing it brilliantly. There are projects like that in the United States, some in Canada, some in Australia, some in Japan, where a lot of this started, and, of course, elsewhere in Europe.
So do we have any of those yet?
Yeah, no, we do. The first one was set up in Clapham in southwest London, called Apples and Honey Nightingale.
The nursery is right on site?
The nursery is on site, right in the middle of this lovely care home in Clapham. And every day the children mix with the older people. It's part of the early years curriculum, so they're learning whilst they're doing that. But then the children also kind of spontaneously can wander around the care home. Older people wander into the nursery. There are communal areas where they undertake activities, or the cafe and restaurant where they mix as well.
So now, this is the critical bit, isn't it? It's not just bussing in a load of kids every couple of weeks. When it's a daily occurrence, the learning goes in both directions, and it must make everyone so much happier.
It is all about relationships, people getting to know each other and building that confidence over time about and supporting. I mean, you know, we're seeing children whose communication skills just blossom as a result of that. The older people have much more time to give those children, and the children can spend time talking with them and finding out what life has been like and is like for those older people.
Did you have a role in establishing Apples and Honey?
No, I mean, Apples and Honey Nightingale would have happened probably without us. But what we have done is to work with them to help promote the scheme. And we've worked very closely with them over the last 2 years, particularly through using the media to highlight what they're doing. Because for too long, we had to rely on examples from other countries to show what was possible. And now we have examples in our own country, in the UK, demonstrating how successful this approach can be. So Apples and Honey Nightingale was the first in the UK, but there are now several sites where a nursery is co-located with a care home, and we're expecting to see many more. Lots are in...
It's across the country, in the north.
Across the UK, lots are in development now. It's a very exciting time.
And what else do you see that gives you a reason to be cheerful about the work that you've done over the past 10 years?
So the work bringing care together, intergenerational care schemes, is really has taken a really good foothold. We're also now beginning to see some intergenerational housing schemes, particularly around using sheltered housing schemes where perhaps they're not so popular with older people as perhaps they used to be. And so some of those are now seeing flats being let to postgraduate students in Cambridge, for example. In London, there's a scheme just about to be launched where some flats are being let to young mothers with young children alongside the older people. And those groups providing mutual support to each other.
Yeah, so, that's the way it should be, shouldn't
and,
it?
Well, it is kind of natural communities, really.
Yeah, yeah. But especially when families are far-flung. Globalisation has... Everybody goes for where they can earn a living and put food on the table for their family, and that means a lot of the time they have to leave their next of kin.
Yeah, and families are much more fragmented now than they ever used to be. I grew up literally living around the corner from my grandmother, and she provided most of our childcare, but that doesn't happen for a lot of people now. So a lot of young children don't necessarily meet older people on a day-to-day or even week-to-week or month-to-month basis. So enabling them to do so through their nursery or their childminder. We're seeing lots of childminders, for example, now basing themselves in care homes or in extra care housing schemes as well. But the growth in intergenerational housing is the next stage. Ultimately, though, I hope that we can see this coming together of older and younger generations spreading right across all age groups, because the beneficiaries aren't just the oldest and the youngest in our society. It's also the relatives of the older people, the sons and daughters of those older people. It's the parents of the children at the nursery. And, of course, it's the staff who are working at the nursery and the care home as well. They all benefit from it as well.
And what is central government's role in all of this?
Well, hopefully at some point, central government will recognise this. And we've had some... early support from Matt Hancock, the Secretary of State for Health and Social Care. We're hoping that the idea is going to be promoted in the government's Care Green Paper that's coming up. So recognition is important because that will encourage others to do follow this approach. But I do hope also that the government can provide some funding to support more of these projects. We've had fantastic support from Ofsted, the Education and Childcare Regulator, and from the Care Quality Commission, which is regulating older people's care. They both recognise the benefits to older people and to young children, and they are supporting intergenerational care wherever it's happening, and they've advised their inspectors on how to regulate it and inspect it when it does occur. That's fantastic in terms of taking it forward, because a lot of providers are a bit nervous about what might the regulator think about all of this and safeguarding issues and so on.
But I guess when you involve government, it's a long runway to getting a result, but at least it's happening.
Yes, but it's, as I said, this is all happening because it's happening under people's own steam. People are making it happen, whether they're parents or older people, or whether they are providers of care and childcare. They are making it happen already in this country. That's the beauty of what's going on. This is a bottom-up grassroots movement.
Mark Friedman, as you know, is one of the most respected campaigners for social cohesion through the generations. He was on the podcast a few weeks ago, and he told us the history of age segregation in the United States, his home country. Was the UK context roughly the same, Stephen?
I think it's pretty similar in the way that families have fragmented, families have moved around all over the world, let alone all over the country. But also, I think the way work is structured has changed, and also the fact that because the housing market, I think, has also had a big impact on this, that younger people tend to live in more city centres and older people tend to live in smaller towns and rural areas. All of those factors have led to growing age segregation, and certainly the statistics show that the UK is one of the most age-segregated countries in the world. Whether it happened exactly the same time in the US, it's difficult to say, because I don't think we were measuring it early on. And our trends tend to follow the US.
Yeah.
So what we're seeing now, and the US led the way on this, but in the US there are many more multi-generational households now than there were 20 years ago. And we're beginning to see that trend happen here as well.
So, I mean, it takes a mind shift, though, doesn't it? Because, we have embedded in our psyche, we have these expectations that 18, 19, 20 years old, out of the nest, fly on your own. And I was looking at some stats from Civitas, the think tank, and it said that in the UK, 49% of 23-year-olds now live with parents, and it was 37% in 1998. To me, that's a good thing. Even though I was mentioning earlier that BBC News piece that I said where the woman was just saying, it's driving me crazy and, my son will never leave. Maybe we need to reorient our thinking around having it welcoming being a multi-generational family.
Well, it's certainly something that occurred in the past, and clearly it's happening again now. I think the big issue from our point of view is whether it's a matter of choice. Whose choice is it that this is happening? A lot of the reason it's happening is pure economic choice, and people don't have the choice. They're being forced to live with their parents because they don't have any housing options beyond living on a subsidised room under their parents' roof.
But the thing is that we all see that as, oh, he's a loser. He's not able to fend for himself, he or she. If they're 23, 25, 28, and they're going back to mum and dad. And maybe we need to reorient our thinking about that.
Well, I agree, if it's a positive choice. And, I think for a lot of young people, they can use that time to build a base, save some money, and then go out and develop their own independent life. But there are also a lot of families who are living in pretty crowded circumstances as well. They don't necessarily have a property that's large enough to really accommodate several adults. And they certainly, the multi-generational households where these things tend to succeed is where you have both shared space and independent space. And there aren't many family homes, particularly in a place like London,
no,
where people
here.
Have that yeah. kind of space.
I mean, I guess for me, I'm just thinking personally, I spent one paradisical year in Cape Town with my closest family. And it was wonderful. Three young kids, my niece, who's like a proxy daughter. And it was fantastic. But of course, I did have my independent space. I would relish being able to get a visa there and going and joining them, because it's the way it should be.
And as I said, I mean, there is actually a growth in this country of families where you've got three or more generations living under the same roof. So people are making that as a positive choice. I think the challenge is to the architects and developers is to actually look at how do we create housing and homes that actually support that positive choice and give people both shared space and independent space so they have the freedom to live together.
This brings me to my next question about one of your other advice schemes that you run under the umbrella of United for All Ages. Tell me about DownsizingDirect.com.
Downsizing Direct is a website that basically promotes the concept of downsizing by older people as a way of enabling them to find housing that's perhaps more appropriate for their particular stage in life, but also it frees up family size housing for younger generations. So we see it as a win-win. And so it promotes the idea of downsizing, and then it can also support older people going through that process themselves.
And that's delivered as part of your social enterprise.
That's right.
So it's free advice.
It's free advice, but if people require support, then obviously if they need help with downsizing, selling, moving, and so on, then there's a fee involved in that.
All right. And what about the other one, the other online scheme that you run, the Good Care Guide?
Yes, the Good Care Guide we set up in 2012. It's very much like a TripAdvisor site to enable families to review and to rate either childcare or elder care that they're using. And it's been very successful. We have just sold a share of that site to Langbuisson, who are now going to be developing and investing in Good Care Guide.
But and what is Langbuisson?
Langbuisson are a social care company, so they're very interested.
Sounds French.
It's not French. They're very much the UK.
Langbuisson? Okay.
Yeah, no, they're very much based in London. And the real reason for developing Good Care Guide was to give the users of care, the families using care, a much bigger say in the quality of that care, and to enable them to voice that publicly and to help drive the improvement of that care. And for me, that's one of the big things that needs to be sorted in our society, whether it's through United for All Ages by having more people going into care homes, or whether it's enabling people to voice their views on the internet. We need to do much more to improve the quality of care as well as the affordability of care in this country.
Yeah, and get more of these communal living schemes up and running.
Well, there are lots of different ways to support people at different stages in their life. So I'm a big fan of extra care housing, where people have their own front door, their own flat, but also they have round-the-clock care support if they need it. I think care homes need to open up much more than they have been, and that's why inviting young people, children into a care home makes a lot of sense in terms of more eyes and ears, but it also about providing more meaningful activities for the people who live in those care homes as well.
What does the near future look like for United for All Ages, Stephen? Is your strategy steady as she goes, or are you growing your resources and
No,
activities?
We're very ambitious. We want to see a centre for all ages in every part of the country. We want to see every nursery and every school, every childminder, every care home and every older people's housing with care scheme actually involved in intergenerational activity. So this becomes commonplace throughout our country. And that's our ultimate ambition.
Do you think we're at sort of a tipping point? You're noticing a lot of change. People, as we said earlier, waking up to this.
People have woken up to it. I think the big change over the last 2-3 years has been the extent of media coverage of these ideas. People now see it happening in the UK, whereas they didn't before. And more people say, why isn't this happening in my care home or my nursery? How do we get started? So people are making that happen. So we want to see it happen everywhere. But beyond that, it's about involving workplaces, it's about involving colleges and universities, supporting people as they go through training and into work. It's about things like mentoring as well. So more schemes where old and young people can work together to solve some of their common issues.
I mean, do you work in that area of this whole longevity revolution that we're seeing now? I'm thinking about ageism in the workplace. as many of the other countries around the world are doing better. We don't seem to be in the UK getting the new model up and running. We still have employers chucking people out in their 50s.
Yes, I think we wasted a huge amount of talent in this country. Too many people have retired early in the UK or been forced out of work. And that's been for all sorts of reasons. We need to make work much more flexible for people in their 50s, 60s and 70s to enable them to carry on working. We need to provide many more options for people in those age groups and support them through training and career development and so on. We're not there yet, but I think society is beginning to change. The figures begin to show that that's where the massive growth in employment is taking place in the UK.
But a lot of it is still nickel and dime jobs. People that had great careers, they'll never get a wonderful job with decent pay and good benefits.
Yeah, I think it's about people perhaps realigning expectations. I think young people have had to do that as well, that they haven't necessarily had all the opportunities they want in their 20s and 30s. I think people need to think about career changes, completely doing something completely different, and perhaps doing a job which is a mix of volunteering with paid work as well. There are
so
all
lower
sorts of
our expectations in terms of financial gain.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is something that's happening across our society in terms of, the sharing communities that are emerging. People don't need massive amount of money these days. What you need is real meaning in your life. And I think you can get that in other ways as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole thing, isn't it? In our 50s and 60s, we yearn for purpose, social purpose. Mm.
And certainly, I think there are plenty of things that those of us in our 50s and 60s and 70s and older can do. And the voluntary sector would survive without people of those ages. But we need to, again, get the voluntary sector to tackle some of the ageism within its own ranks as well.
Stephen Burke, director of the UK's United for All Ages, a social enterprise closing the gap between the generations. Thank you so much, Stephen. Very interesting.
Thank you, Susan.
Stephen Burke is a former chief executive of two national care charities and the leader of a London borough. And now he's also chair and trustee of several housing, care and ageing charities and an NHS clinical commissioning group. You'll find links, as ever, in the show notes to this episode. Big thanks, of course, to this week's sponsor, Five Aside Chess, and to you for listening. Cheers for your kind reviews on my website, susanflory.com, and wherever you listen to this podcast, Stitcher, Spotify, Google, or Apple Podcasts. Find me on Twitter, @TheBigMiddlePod. Let's chat there until the next one. Bye-bye.